China invests big on the Pacific coast of Peru with the opening of a giant container port.
This is the largest expansion project, really, to date that I know of in the Latin American region.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. What the new megaport says about China's role in Latin America.
Also today, European regulators just hit Meta with a nearly $1 billion fine. Will it matter?
For very large companies, this often just gets baked into the cost of business.
Plus, the minaret of Mosul, Iraq rises from the ashes. And in Spain, local leaders getting some heat after deadly flash flooding.
Francamente, usted va a ser un personaje histórico. Será el
You'll go down in history, says his politician, as the man who brought us climate change denial.
That's all ahead today on The World.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for spending part of your day with us today. President Joe Biden is on a six-day trip to South America right now. He's currently in Peru meeting with leaders from the Asia-Pacific region before he heads over to Brazil.
But another high-profile event happening tonight in Peru is likely to eclipse Biden's visit. That is the inauguration of a huge commercial port built by China, with President Xi Jinping in attendance as a guest of honor. The world's Tibi Saizea starts us off with this report.
The city of Chancay used to be a sleepy fishing and farming village in the Pacific coast of Peru. It was popular with tourists and birds migrating from North America until a Chinese company started building a huge commercial port there. Margaret Myers at the Inter-American Dialogue describes the magnitude of this project.
This is the largest expansion project, really, to date that I know of in the Latin American region.
And all eyes seem to be on this inauguration tonight. The giant Chinese company COSCO invested $1.3 billion to get exclusivity to operate this port. It will be able to receive bigger cargo ships and will create a more efficient route across the Pacific Ocean.
It will be sort of the central hub for cross-Pacific trade and will boost Peruvian export while also facilitating the importation of a wider range of goods from China and other Asian countries.
The port will also benefit other South American countries like Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, and Colombia. South America exports copper, lithium, and produce to China and imports a lot of machinery and electronics from the Asian country. Mayer says the new trade route will expand China's influence in Latin America even more.
If we look across the entirety of the region, China is the top trade partner for most countries, including nearly every country in South America.
This wasn't the case just two decades ago when Latin America used to look to the U.S. almost exclusively for trade opportunities. Eric Farnsworth, a former State Department official now at the Council of the Americas, explains why that changed.
Latin America needs infrastructure. They need financing for it. And China shows up and they say we have money and we're not going to make a lot of demands or put a lot of conditionality on our project. And so let's do business together.
With the opening of the Chancay port, it looks like the U.S. is on the losing side of a trade battle with China. The first Trump administration did try to defend Latin America from Chinese inroads, but Trump's threat to establish new tariffs could put the U.S. at a disadvantage, according to Farnsworth.
If you're a country like Peru and you're exporting your products to the United States, if those now become more expensive, by definition, you're going to be sending less to the United States. You could actually predict that some in the region would find it even more convenient to go toward China.
Many Peruvians are happy about Chinese investments in their country. Diego Marcera is an economist in Lima.
This is a positive development. We could have more products that were not being able to export to Asia because they perish in the way, being able to actually reach Chinese markets in a shorter amount of time. That could be very important for many agricultural workers.
Chinese and Peruvian officials have said the Chancay port is a purely commercial facility, but the level of Chinese involvement in Chancay is causing security concerns about Peru potentially being used as a military base for China. Evan Ellis is a Latin America professor with the U.S. Army College.
And so Chiang Kai is both sufficiently far away from the United States with the possibility to maintain supplies there and Navy warships.
General Laura Richardson is the former head of the U.S. Southern Command, and she told the Financial Times that this is, quote, a playbook that we've seen play out in other places. President Biden was also on the guest list for the Chiang Kai port inauguration in Peru, but he chose not to attend. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaya, Mexico City.
European Union regulators took another step today to rein in the dominance of big tech, slapping an $840 million fine on Meta. The EU essentially ruled that Meta, the company that owns Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, created an unfair advantage by bundling its marketplace into Facebook's wider social network. Meta says the ruling failed to prove competitive harm to rivals, and it vows to appeal. Eva Galperin directs cybersecurity at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
What the government alleges is essentially that by creating a marketplace that uses the information which Facebook already has about you and which Meta has about you through Facebook, but also through its other products such as WhatsApp and Instagram, it is better able to target ads at you that are appealing and personalized, and that this gives them a competitive advantage on Facebook Marketplace.
And Marketplace is just a place where people can post that they have, you know, an old dresser for sale or anything else, and then people within their network or without can buy it from them.
Yes, but the ads on Marketplace are how Facebook makes its money. So when you go to Facebook Marketplace, you then see a bunch of personalized ads, which are based on information that it gathers about you, not only on Facebook Marketplace, but also on Facebook more generally, and also on Facebook's other extremely popular platforms.
Right. Now, $840 million seems, of course, like a whole lot of money to me, but how significant is it for Meta, which is, you know, one of the biggest corporations in the world?
I worry that it is not as significant a fine as it might sound like to an ordinary person. One of the problems with these very, very large fines is that for very large companies, this often just gets baked into the cost of business. The most important thing is that under this ruling, Facebook has to stop these anti-competitive practices.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Ireland fined Meta $1.3 billion a year and a half ago. Did that have an impact on the company?
It's not entirely clear that these fines are large enough to have an impact even once they start edging up into the, you know, $1 billion mark. But getting them to stop bad practices combined with large fines is possibly effective.
So with this ruling, how would you contrast the EU's approach on regulating big tech companies with what the US is doing?
Well, what's really interesting is that in the last few years, we've actually seen a lot of movement in the sort of antitrust space in the United States when it comes to reining in big tech. The FTC under Lina Khan has been really active in preventing anti-competitive mergers and also in pursuing really significant cases against Apple and against Google and also against Meta. The bad news is that the incoming administration does not share Lina Khan's enthusiasm for reining in big tech.
For users who are concerned about their privacy and security, do you think it's better to be, you know, logging on from Europe or logging on from the U.S.?
It depends. Privacy legislation in the EU is actually quite strong. But I would say that U.S. companies are generally better on security when it comes to making sure that your accounts are secure. The consequences of failing to do so are more severe in the United States than they are in the EU. So everything is a series of trade-offs.
That's Eva Galperin from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We've reached out to Meta for comment. Spokesperson Matt Pollard writes that Meta strongly disagrees with the decision, which he said provides no evidence of competitive harm. Pollard said Meta will appeal the ruling.
Climate activists and government officials from around the world traveled to Azerbaijan this week to attend COP29, the annual United Nations Summit on Climate Change. Observers are pointing out something they see as a contradiction there, that a sizable number of attendees flew to the big climate conference on private jets, which, as the world's Jeremy Siegel reports, account for a significant amount of greenhouse gas emissions.
Let's go back to February.
And yes, the first Super Bowl in Las Vegas.
Super Bowl 58, an historic event, not just because it was held in Sin City for the first time, or because it was the most watched U.S. broadcast since the moon landing.
It's probably one of the most emission-intensive things that we could do as humans on the planet.
But also because of the greenhouse gas emissions it caused, with nearly 900 private jets landing in Vegas ahead of the event. Alice Larkin, who studies aircraft emissions at the University of Manchester, says private jets, drawn by events like these, are the epitome of unnecessary pollution.
It's roughly between 5 and 9 times more emission intensive than a standard economy flight.
According to a new study published in the journal Communications Earth and Environment, private flights are on the rise, with emissions up nearly 50% over 5 years. The research also found private aviation is often clustered around big international events, including the Super Bowl, the World Cup, and last year's COP28 summit in Dubai. Jean Hsu, the Energy Justice Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, a group attending this year's COP summit, says the irony is not lost on her.
It is truly egregious and disgusting to see billionaires, trillionaires fly on private jets and exacerbate the very problem that we're all trying to solve.
The recent study doesn't include data from this year's summit in Baku, but an analysis of flight data conducted for the world by the flight tracking service Flight Radar 24 shows that 67 private flights arrived in Baku around the start of the event, more than double the previous weekend. Sue says organizers of the summit should take note.
The United Nations has the ability to issue policies that say we don't accept attendees who fly here via disproportionate means of, you know, emission spewing, and that includes private jets.
This year's summit does have a sustainability policy that calls for carbon neutrality and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but there's no mention of air travel, and organizers didn't respond to requests for comment on whether their goals include travel or whether they've considered asking attendees not to take private jets. Some private aircraft companies, for their part, have launched sustainability initiatives, with the U.S.-based Flexjet, for example, claiming to offset its emissions by supporting renewable projects around the world. Magdalena Heuwieser co-founded the organization Stay Grounded, based in Germany. She wants to see the private aviation industry done away with entirely.
We demand a ban of private jets. We want no more exceptions for the ultra-rich.
A recent report for the anti-poverty organization Oxfam International found that jets and superyachts owned by ultra-wealthy Europeans emit more carbon pollution in a week than the world's poorest 1% emits in a lifetime. Alex Maitland authored that report and agrees that luxury travel needs to be reined in through regulation. But ultimately, he says, the problem is cultural.
Some research which was conducted based on interviews with super wealthy found that when people were asked, why do you own a super yacht? It's because it's a status symbol. Their friends will have one, and so they feel that they should have one as well.
The University of Manchester's Alice Larkin says that gets to the heart of the issue, that there needs to be a cultural shift surrounding how and why we travel.
If you see your leaders flying to meetings who are going by private jet and then telling us that we need to change, you know, our boilers in our households because we need to reduce emissions, it just lacks that credibility if you're not consistent in your messaging.
Larkin herself hasn't flown in more than a decade. Not because she says her own individual actions will do much to alleviate emissions, but because when it comes to fighting climate change, it's just as important to walk the walk as it is to talk the talk, even if that means not getting to COP. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Patty Daniels. I'm the supervising producer for The World. When you think about this show, you might think first about the voices and the reporting you hear. It's essential journalism, and it makes you feel connected to the world around you. But there's so much more that is going on behind the scenes. It's our producers and our editors, the engineer who's behind the glass right next to me, our studio team. We're all working together to make sure this is the best journalism with the highest production values. We have to be nimble, we have to be responsive, and we rely on deep experience to make sure that this news program is the best that it can be for you every afternoon. We can't do this work without you. We have a fundraising goal right now through the end of December to raise $67,000 to support this nonprofit newsroom, and we're counting on you to make this campaign a success. Trusted global journalism, that is already reason enough to give. But here is one more incentive, my friends. Now through December 31st, your donation will be matched. Think about making a gift of $250 to the world, and our newsroom will receive $500 thanks to you and thanks to the power of teamwork. You are part of our effort here, and we couldn't thank you enough. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you. Now here's the show.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Spanish province of Valencia is still cleaning up. Deadly flash floods last month that hit towns across the region killed hundreds of people. Scientists say climate change made the rainfall more severe. Turns out Valencia's conservative government also failed to warn residents in time to get out of harm's way. The officials calling the shots there say they don't believe climate change is real. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
The floodwaters around Valencia have receded, and now the internet is being inundated with video clips of people like this woman.
Ay, bajo. Ay, madre mía.
Ay. She filmed herself barely escaping a parking garage as the rainwater rushed in. By that point, her same phone should have already received this. This is a typical emergency alert from the government. In Valencia, the alerts warned people to seek safety and avoid traveling on roads. Problem was, they arrived hours late. Why? Well, this is Carlos Mazón, the Valencia region's conservative president, speaking hours before the floods. He downplayed the dangers of the approaching storm, telling citizens that the rain would be over by 6 p.m. Mazón then went on with his day, meetings, a long lunch, despite repeated warnings from Spain's National Weather Service that something really big was brewing. And by 8 o'clock... Streets across the region were under rushing water. Just how the man who should have been out in front of the storm acted like it wasn't there is the subject of fierce debate, a debate that started last year, actually, as soon as Mazón and his right-wing coalition came to power. You are going to go down in history, climate journalist and politician Juan Bordera warned Mazón in Valencia's parliament. He said, they'll recall you as the man who ushered in climate change denial. Mazón and his conservative Popular Party are vocal skeptics of climate change. Once in power, Mazón began defunding and dismantling Valencia's emergency response department, and he put a like-minded politician, Salomé Pradas, in charge of it.
Ahí es cuando un técnico nos informa que existe un mecanismo que se denomina ESALERT.
Pradas told reporters this week that during the height of the flooding, she learned about this thing she'd never heard of. They're called S-alerts, she said. S-alerts, you know, the things that go on your phone to warn you. More than 200 people died in Valencia's flooding. Most had been caught off guard. Once the floodwaters receded, the chaos continued. Mazón waited days to allow military rescue teams into the worst-hit areas, like here in Paiporta. Residents were left to dig out and to find food and water largely on their own. So when Mazón came to tour the destruction on day five, angry mobs threw mud at him.
No se explica las tontadas que ha hecho.
Even Spain's conservative press has gone after Valencia's leader. Popular radio host Federico Jiménez Los Santos has called on Mazón to step down. How could he have screwed up so royally, he asked. Mazón on TV and radio has said he acted as quickly as he could based on the information he had. Meanwhile, there's nothing to indicate that Spain's conservatives are changing their stance on climate change. Here's Juan García Gallardo from the far-right Vox party. Fox was, until a few months ago, a member of Valencia's ruling coalition.
Vinculando la gota fría de Valencia con el cambio climático es un insulto.
Linking the Valencia floods to climate change is an insult to the victims of this disaster, he told Spain's Congress last week. There were floods centuries ago, he said, long before people started talking about carbon emissions.
Desde que la Tierra existe desde el origen, ha habido siempre cambio.
In another recent speech, Popular Party leader Isabel Díaz Ayuso said that climate change has existed as long as the Earth has. She accused experts of secretly using science to impose communism. But in the wake of Valencia's flooding, other regions seem to have learned from its mistakes. As big storms approached the southern city of Malaga this week, the S alerts went out early and often. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
In South Africa, there's an illegal trading network that's illicitly selling the body parts of tigers. That network includes farms where the big cats are raised. An international animal welfare foundation called Four Paws has just put out a report about this. It details how tiger body parts are traded illegally for use in traditional medicine in places like China and Vietnam. Fiona Miles is the director of Four Paws in Cape Town, South Africa.
In South Africa, there are more than 350 big cat facilities, in other words, farms that are breeding big cats for commercial purposes. And in many cases, they are open to the public, where the public can see these animals, they can interact with them. And in many cases, what we have perceived and seen over the years, they are not suitable for the big cats. They're obviously specific needs as big cats. This ranges from all the big cat species, lion, which is the biggest captive bred big cats in South Africa, to tiger, leopard, cheetah, and various other non-indigenous species.
And so in your report, you detailed how some of these tigers are what, being raised explicitly for use in traditional Chinese medicine?
That's right. Alongside the lions in South Africa, tigers are also being bred for commercial purposes. And this, of course, is not supposed to happen, given the global protection of tigers. But South Africa does not have the necessary protection in place for tigers. And according to the latest government statistics, there's more than 600 tigers being bred in South Africa. We anticipate that the number is much larger, and certainly over a long period of time, more than 30 years, that this industry has been allowed to grow and be exacerbated. Tigers have been bred alongside the lion and other big cats.
Which tiger parts get used for Chinese medicine and for what? Can you give me some examples?
So some examples are the fact that in Asian medicine and traditional use and other use, the carcasses, the bones, are steeped in alcohol and are used as tiger wine. We've seen the bones being boiled down to form tiger glue, or other parts and derivatives are used, for example, in fashionable accessories. So teeth and hair and claws are used in those businesses. And if you have a look at some of the parts of the report, it's really, really shocking that people are demanding this or asking for this. And this is what we want to also show, is that the demand for this needs to be also educated on and reduced.
So these farms themselves are legal under South African law, but trading in the parts of tigers is not, correct?
So in South Africa, it is legal to breed and trade with these animals. Internationally, of course, under the CITES regulations, it is not legal to commercially trade. But of course, there are many loopholes, and this is exactly the problem. We need to see an end to the intensive breeding on more than 350 farms in South Africa. In South Africa alone, there are more than 12,000 lions being bred, and then an unknown number. The official number is 600 and something, but the fact of the matter is it's an unknown number of tigers and other big cats that are being bred. And this is exactly the problem. And so South Africa itself needs to really see an end to the breeding of these animals for commercial purposes.
Fiona Miles is with the animal welfare group Four Paws. She's in Cape Town, South Africa. You're listening to The World.
In South Africa, there's a standoff deep underground. Hundreds of miners are holed up in the crude tunnels of an illegal gold mine, refusing to leave.
It's absolutely labyrinthine, an enormous scale of subterranean infrastructure, much of it abandoned.
But now the police are playing hardball to force the miners out. That's still to come here on The World.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. The clock is ticking. With just over 2 months until the inauguration of Donald Trump, the Biden administration is looking to boost support for Ukraine while it can. That means more money for military aid and a pledge to allow U.S. military contractors to work in the country. This is a recent policy reversal for Washington. The World's Daniel Offman reports that the contractors will play a limited but significant role on the ground in Ukraine.
For nearly 3 years now, President Biden has said that the U.S. stands with Ukraine and will support its ability to defend itself. That support has come through diplomatic cooperation, intelligence sharing, and most significantly, military aid. What Biden has said he won't do is put U.S. boots on the ground.
They can't deploy U.S. troops. That would be political suicide for them, to put it bluntly.
This is Christopher Kinsey, a professor of international security at King's College London. He says that there are multiple reasons why the U.S. won't send regular troops into Ukraine.
I don't believe there's any appetite from the U.S. public to put uniformed personnel on the ground. It would also be seen as an escalation of the war. So it's not an escalation they would want.
There are other reasons, though, why the U.S. would want to send personnel into Ukraine, and that's where military contractors come into the picture.
A lot of them are former military people, because to get the training to service this type of equipment, you don't develop that skill outside of the military.
Robert Hamilton is a retired U.S. Army colonel with the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia.
Whether it's a Patriot air defense system or an M1 tank or an F-16 or whatever, what we're talking about here in Ukraine is you've got contractors who service specialized equipment that either the U.S. military or the partner nation, in this case Ukraine, doesn't have the capability to do that level of maintenance itself.
Hamilton says that the U.S. and other countries have already done this type of maintenance work outside of Ukraine's borders. But the model has been too slow and too costly, so the contractors will be closer to where the fight is. Hamilton says these contractors get paid well because they have highly specialized skills, and most of them know how to work in a war zone.
I think the Russians, if they know where they are, they will target them. And so there will be an operational security requirement that's going to be pretty high to make sure that the Russians don't know where they work, don't know where they live, their profile is low. They're not going to be driving around in vehicles with the name of the company emblazoned on the door.
And that's another reason why, according to Professor Christopher Kinsey, contractors are a useful resource for governments.
What they're able to do is they can escalate up and they can escalate back down, and they can do that out of sight of the public. Also, there's this notion of deniability. The American government can't be blamed if things go wrong. They will blame the contractor.
Kinsey says that one of the biggest critiques against the use of military contractors is that they come with less transparency and accountability.
You can bypass Congress. So that's another reason why people are opposed to it. It makes actually engaging in war easier because you don't need society to buy in this respect, because you don't need conscription.
In this case, the contractors that are being sent to Ukraine will be limited to upkeeping and repairing weapon systems, so they won't be directly involved in fighting and likely won't be positioned near the front lines. However, Kinsey says that their presence in Ukraine already sends a message to Russia.
We may not be putting ground troops in, but we're certainly putting people in with weapon systems that know how to use these weapon systems. So if you don't toe the line, then I'll just increase the number of contractors.
According to recent polls, a significant portion of the U.S. public does not support continued aid to Ukraine. That's especially true among Republicans. So whether the incoming Trump administration will carry on with this policy remains a question. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
7 years after it was destroyed by ISIS, the iconic Al-Hadba Minaret in Mosul, Iraq, has finally been restored. Oh, That's the Azan, or Islamic call to prayer, being broadcast from the rebuilt minaret for the first time since restoration was completed. Ali al-Baroudi is an Iraqi photographer and photojournalist from Mosul. He's been following the restoration of the landmark since it began. Can you describe the old al-Hadba minaret for us, Ali? It was centuries old, right? Part of the al-Nuri Mosque. And famously, that minaret was leaning to one side, right?
Yes, it is one of the identity marks of Mosul. Mosul is known by many things, but Al-Hadba Minaret is like the distinctive mark. The tallest structure in the old town. The old town is very, very plain, and all of a sudden you see almost a 55-meter high structure built 850 years ago. It's a truly a miraculous building, and sometimes we fall short of words, and that's why it was a priority to bring it back.
Yeah, 55 meters, that's more than 150 feet. So the minaret must be visible from the outer limits of Mosul, yeah?
Yeah, you can see it in many parts. Even during the liberation battle, we used to see it from this part of the city, sometimes wrapped and blanketed by smoke plumes of the battle. And most of the people were wondering, is it going to keep standing? Because there were many warnings and projects to restore it, even before ISIS. In 2011, there were some news, shocking news about the fragility of the structure. And imagine like a huge urban battle hitting that ancient old part of the city. And we were all wondering, is it going to stand it? Is it going to survive the war like the people around it? And you know, what happened back then.
Well, yeah, how was it destroyed in 2017?
Well, according to the footage circulated on social media and analyzed by many experts, it seems that the structure and the mosque and the whole compound were rigged with explosives. And up to a couple of weeks ago, they were working and restoring, and they were still finding explosives inside the mosque. And the work stopped a couple of weeks ago. There were some hidden explosives inside the mosque.
Wow, still?
Yeah. Up to like a couple of weeks ago, there were some explosives found, and the site was evacuated, and then they were removed and dismantled away from the compound. So it was at night. It was the 21st of June. ISIS were cornered in the old town during the battle. And
this is 2017, right?
Yes, 2017. And it was like a giant thing in our mind. And that image of the Hadba leaning minaret is no longer there. That was beyond description. It was shock. Imagine that a structure that is 850 years ancient stood all those centuries with many waves of invaders and occupiers, and nobody touched this beauty. And all of a sudden, it's down. We kept wondering, like, why?
What was the reaction among people and yourself when this happened?
Like tears and sadness and shock, as if we lost a family member. That's what all people said. Because in Mosul, one of the names of the Hadba minaret was like our mother minaret, our mother Hadba. So it was like losing a family member.
So the newly restored minaret, Ali, what does it look like?
No, it is not as leaning as before, which is good because the architectural factors were taken into consideration. It is leaning. It's not as leaning as before, and this is a positive thing. Again, you can see it from all around city. You can see it from Eastern Mosul. I live in Eastern Mosul, and we can see some parts. We can see it from the older bridge. We can see it next to the churches. You know, the minaret and the church tower. This is the old town. This is Mosul, the multi-ethnic, multi-religious city.
How did it feel to see this process completed, Ali?
Well, there are many things, to be honest. There are scores of millions of dollars pumped into Mosul, which is encouraging and supporting the wheel of reconstruction. And it is not only the mosque, by the way. There are many churches that were included in the project in the initiative of restoring the ancient sites. Let's not forget the Dominican Church of the Clock. It's fully back. Let's not forget the Al-Tahira Church, where Pope Francis prayed about 3 years ago. It was restored and it will be reopened soon. And that's all within the initiative of restoring these precious ancient sites. Most importantly, the role of the Hatba Minaret is not only seen in Mosul skyline and Mosul cityscape. The minaret opened windows to for Mosul to the world. There are now thousands of tourists, diplomats, diplomatic missions, NGOs visiting Mosul and knowing something about this. When I talk about this openness, this may not be well understood by many people around the world. For us, it is something new to be open to the world. So the minaret is not only back in our skyline, but it is giving Mosul, the city, the warm bed of the minaret is giving it a window to the world. So you may know something about us.
How real a sign is the restoration of the minaret and the rest of the old city? How real a sign is it that the city is getting back on its feet and putting ISIS in the rear view?
If you look at the heritage restaurants and cafes and institutions and local museums around the old town, you can see more and more. You know, there are like the scars of war are not easy to erase overnight or even in 8 years, but life is already back there.
That's Ali al-Baroudi, an Iraqi photojournalist. He joined us from Mosul, Iraq, which he calls home, and where the famous al-Habda Minaret has been rebuilt. While you've been focused on the big headlines, here are a few news items that you may have missed.
Like the discovery of the world's largest coral. It is so big it can be seen from space. Scientists say they found it near the Solomon Islands in the Pacific, and the coral is, as they put it, pulsing with life and color. Researchers say it's likely been growing for 300 years or more.
There's this news about a once suspicious beluga whale. A few years ago, some Norwegians at sea reportedly came across a friendly beluga. It enjoyed playing fetch and getting scratches. It also had a camera harness that was stamped in English, equipment of St. Petersburg. So naturally, the Norwegians assumed it was a spy whale sent by Russia. Well, that theory has now been debunked a full 5 years later. A marine mammal researcher says that the whale, nicknamed Vladimir, was not actually a Russian spy. Instead, it was a whale in training to be guarding a Russian military base. But apparently, the whale went a-wandering. Russia has long trained aquatic mammals to patrol waters near sensitive outposts and bases.
And the world's largest offshore solar farm is going online. The 3,000-acre facility is 5 miles off the coast of China's Shandong province. When it's really cranking, the solar farm can generate more than a gigawatt of electricity. That is enough power to meet the needs of nearly 3 million urban residents. China is the world's top carbon emitter, but Beijing is also trying to develop greener energy sources.
And those are a few things you may have missed.
The Japanese islands of Okinawa sit off the southernmost point of the country. They are actually closer to China and Taiwan than they are to the Japanese mainland. In other words, they are strategically important to all those countries, plus the United States. And for decades, a small but vocal group of activists have been calling for Okinawa's independence from Japan. Now they have an ally willing to stir up support for their movement, Beijing. Reporter Rebecca Rossman went to Okinawa to find out more.
Eiichi Miyanga, or Chibi as he's better known, has been singing about his dreams of Okinawan independence for years. The 73-year-old is the lead singer of Koza BC Band. Every weekend, the band plays a double set in this no-frills upstairs bar, just off the main drag in this busy nightlife district.
We're not Japanese, so we don't have to go back to Japan. We have our own kingdom.
He's referring to the Ryukyu Kingdom. The song he's singing is called Wake Up, Ryukyu. For centuries, these islands were self-governed under the independent Ryukyu Kingdom, which had tributary ties to Beijing. Japan formally annexed the archipelago in the late 19th century, repressing the native Ryukyu language and culture, then forcing Okinawans to make the ultimate sacrifice in World War II.
We're continually moving in closer toward Okinawa Shima.
Nearly a third of the civilian population was killed, one of the bloodiest battles of the war. Today, Okinawa hosts 32 American military bases as part of an agreement between the U.S. and Japanese mainland. The American presence in Okinawa is seen as increasingly important to Japan and the U.S., given its geographic proximity to China and Taiwan. That may be why Beijing has ramped up its efforts to amplify voices of independence activists like Chibi, says American researcher and historian Robert D. Eldridge.
It's seeking multiple ways to drive a wedge between Okinawa Prefecture or some of the people in Okinawa with the central government and between Japan and the United States.
But most of it is subtle, Eldridge says. Like last year, when Chinese President Xi Jinping made public remarks claiming the status of Okinawa was, quote, unresolved, and suggesting that China had historical territorial claims to the islands. Then there's a recent investigation from the Japanese newspaper Nikkei Asia, looking into a wave of misleading videos pushing for Okinawan independence.
Shuri Castle is a symbol of independence of the Ryukyuan people.
It turns out these videos were actually part of a wider disinformation campaign being run out of Beijing. Still, support for independence in Okinawa remains small, hovering at around 10%. Younger people, like those we spoke to in this university cafeteria, tend to be more nuanced about independence. 22-year-old Miyu Yonoshiro studies management here at the University of the Ryukyus.
People from Okinawa or other, like, mainland too, they have to see the both sides and not only, like, the bad sides. And we have to understand, like, what are good point and bad point.
Yonoshiro says she worries about how Okinawa could economically survive without support from the Japanese mainland. And as talk of a potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan escalates, she feels increasingly protected by U.S. military presence here. But for older Okinawans like Chibi, the American presence here remains a touchy subject. Chibi himself is half American. His dad was a soldier who came to Okinawa in the 50s and left before Chibi was born. Today, Chibi wears a cowboy hat, speaks English, and half the songs in his band's repertoire are 70s rock hits. But for too long, Chibi says, the U.S. military has failed to respect Okinawans.
First time they came to Okinawa, I fight with them.
That was in the late 60s and early 70s, when soldiers came to do their training before heading to Vietnam. He says the soldiers came with a sense of entitlement, a reputation that's never fully gone away. There have been recent scandals, including several high-profile sexual assault cases involving U.S. soldiers. When I asked Chibi if he's aware or concerned about China's increasing role in his quest for independence, he shakes his head.
We're not China. We're not China. We're not America. We're not any other country.
We are Ryukyu, he says. This isn't anyone's hometown, but ours. For the World, Rebecca Rossman, Cannon Bar, Okinawa.
You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In South Africa, police are trying to shut down an illegal gold mine, but it is complicated because thousands of illegal miners, they're called Zamazamas in South Africa, are still underground inside the closed-off mine shafts. This is in a town called Stilfontein, where law enforcement has halted the delivery of food and supplies to the miners in the hope that they'll be forced to come to the surface. Kimonde Grief is a reporter based in South Africa who writes about illegal gold mining there.
The first reports around a week or more ago were of around 500 Zamas coming to the surface, illegal miners. A few came up last week. The police are saying that there's 4,000 underground. I spoke to somebody in the community who said that people in the community are saying that it could be 10 or 15,000 underground.
That's extraordinary.
I'm sure the true number lies somewhere in between there. But there's the standoff where the cops are waiting and the people down there don't want to come up.
How deep underground are they?
So the tunnels in that area, some of them are 2 kilometers or deeper.
Wow.
Yeah, it's the world's deepest gold mines are in South Africa. So what this looks like is a vertical shaft plunging into the earth, horizontal tunnels cutting off at various levels. A single shaft can have hundreds, if not thousands, of kilometers of tunnel associated with it. Stilfontein, I believe, has close to a dozen shafts. So it's absolutely labyrinthine, an enormous scale of subterranean infrastructure, much of it abandoned. There's been big swings and crashes in the gold price historically. And so it's an industry that's sort of habituated to abandoning areas and then going back to them. When that abandonment became more permanent, a lot of companies sold off their assets to other companies, and the sort of responsibility to rehabilitate and seal off these shafts often just got handed on and handed on and was weakly enforced.
These miners, or Zama-Zamas as they're known, you've met some before. Who are they? Where do they come from?
Most Zama-Zamas who get arrested in whenever they do these clampdowns are from Lesotho, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe, three countries that neighbor South Africa.
Right.
And these are all countries that sent large, large numbers of mine workers to work on the mines during apartheid as laborers to depress the price of labor, of black labor under apartheid. South Africa's mining industry actively recruited miners from further and further afield. And so in a sense, there's this kind of historic migration to work on the mines that has now bled into this migration to work on these illegal mines that have flourished.
Right. The phrase Zama-Zama, where does that come from?
The kind of common understanding is that it's a derivation of take a chance. So you go take your chance, look for some gold.
It is hard to imagine living underground for so long. You met one Zama-Zama who'd been down in the mine for 2 years straight, which is just unimaginable. What is life like for them down there?
The reason that people stay underground for so long, firstly, is that these shafts produce a large quantity of gold. They're very valuable and they're illegal. So they're controlled by incredibly powerful criminal syndicates. So to get in and out, Zamas have to pay quite considerable sums. And there's also a risk of getting caught coming up and down by the authorities if they're patrolling that particular area or if it's close to a functioning mine shaft that's still open. And so there's a sort of economic imperative to stay underground. Some people get trapped down there. It's like a sort of form of indentured labor, because when you're down there, you need to pay food, you need to buy food and water, and the same syndicates sell those at incredibly marked up prices. So people live down there for months, years at a time. That's not uncommon. Temperatures can be, you know, 90, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, incredibly humid, dusty, dark. These tunnels have collapsed in many places. Also underground are battles between rivals. So when mine rescuers sometimes go down there, they come across mass graves of people who've been executed underground. So let alone the physical dangers, there's also criminal dangers. It's the most dystopian kind of underworld imaginable. And I still can't really imagine it because I haven't been there, but I've spoken to people who have. And it truly boggles the mind to think of thousands upon thousands of men toiling in those conditions. I mean, right now there's military troops patrolling the entrances to the shafts, and that's why they can't get food down. Wow. Eventually the troops are going to move on, and the structural forces that kind of drive this are still there, which is that there's gold in the ground, that there's people desperate enough to get it, that there's a market for it, that prices are high. And all of this gold ends up on the licit market. It gets laundered into the gold economy at large.
Kimon de Rief is a freelance reporter in Johannesburg, South Africa, where he's writing a book about illegal gold mining.
And now we'd like you to meet Daisy.
Oh, dear. The page is taking a while to load. What's that? You like want me to check my email?
Sweet, trusting, not that tech savvy. She sounds like a phone scammer's dream.
Oh, dear, I think I clicked the wrong button.
But sounds can be deceiving. Daisy is actually a scammer's worst nightmare.
I'm an AI created to waste phone scammers' time.
That's right. Daisy is not a real person. She's a conversational AI created by the British telephone company O2. Her purpose is to drive callers with ulterior motives insane by wasting as much of their time as humanly or robotically possible. The longer Daisy spends on the phone with fraudsters, the less time they have to target real victims. Some of her calls last as long as 40 minutes.
So W's then a dot.
Three times W and then dot.
I think your profession is bothering people, right?
I'm just trying to have a little chat.
It's nearly been an hour! For the love of...
Gosh, how time flies.
Daisy doesn't need real-time input from her creators to keep up her end of the conversation. She can talk about knitting, pets.
It's showing me a picture of my cat, Fluffy.
It's showing you a picture of your cat, Fluffy.
Stop calling me dear, you stupid...
Got it, dear.
All the while playing on scammers' assumptions about senior citizens and using those assumptions against them.
According to O2, the company behind Daisy, the robo-granny has her own phone number. The company plugged the number into known call lists used by scammers. But Daisy isn't just taking their time. She's also collecting data, like when scammers are most likely to call, the kinds of information they're going after, and the tactics they're using.
No doubt helpful, but the best part about this, sweet, sweet revenge. Who doesn't want to beat scammers at their own game? If you ever do find yourself unwittingly caught in a phone call with a scammer, here is a low-tech way to handle it. Just slip your phone under a metal colander, then pick up a spoon, any spoon will do, and... According to Instagram, works like a charm.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.